the country pay or subsidize student fees?
I think so, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's well worth it. I mean, I know plenty of people who've gone to university and they've been subsidised, and I think it's a good thing for the community, it's for the country, in fact. So I think it's a very good idea.
Likewise, I didn't go to uni myself, but I think that education's important. So if that helps them get them through it, then it can only boost the economy, really.
It's difficult because my daughter went to Newport University about 3 years ago. She got a degree, but she got a student loan, £3,000 then. Trouble is, with the cutbacks, everyone's facing it. Universities can't pay students when they're in their money in the overall budget throughout the country. From what I can see, from what the government says, that if you're of a poor background or not so much money, that you'll get a grant anyway. And plus the fact, if you do go to university, then you earn less than £21,000. You may not even get a job, and you may not even have to pay those tuition fees back as a student loan. So I don't know what they're fussing all about, to be honest.
At the moment, if they're making the cuts, it means that only the sort of more fortunate people can afford to study. But at the same time, I think that people have sort of misunderstood the idea of the cuts, and that by increasing it, more people like from poorer backgrounds will be able to study, because it will actually work out that they'll pay back less in the future.
I think they should be subsidised if someone's on a low income. But otherwise, I think it's quite normal. Everywhere else in Europe pays fees, and I don't see why we should be any different. The government haven't got the money to pay for it. The money's got to come from somewhere. So, yeah, it's just hard. It's the way life is. It's the way it is.
If they want the country to prosper, then they need to put some input into the people who are trying to learn and better themselves. Not everybody can afford to be students, you know. We have a class system in this country where, yeah, the upper class can afford to pay for their own fees, but that doesn't mean the lower class people are sick.
I think they should. I think we've got a responsibility to educate young people. I think by paying fees is the best way to do it. It ensures that anyone from any background can get to university.
Should taxpayers' money be used to subsidise Welsh students and not English students?
That's difficult, isn't it? Because Wales got their own assembly and they decide what they want to do with it. So really is that to the people of Wales to say, well, do we want to subsidise students when they could face cutbacks and a lot of things? What are they going to cut back on if they subsidise students, Welsh students? So it remains to be seen what they will cut back on. Will they cut back on hospitals? Will they cut back on roads? Will they cut back on benefits? Anything like that sort of thing. So it's up to the Welsh people to decide what they want to do about that.
We are different countries at the end of the day. We don't subsidise other countries to come here, to my knowledge. And like sort of the Welsh population do get a say in sort of who's going to be our next Prime Minister and stuff like that. They get to vote, but we don't actually get to vote for their. So I think it's a bit of a tricky question, but I'm not sure that we should, to be honest.
I think the taxpayer's paying enough for everything already. It's the same. I mean, the only way that they can subsidise or leave the fees smaller is to tax people more, and we're taxed enough, so no.
Will universities become a place for the children of the rich?
Yes, they would, which is definitely a bad thing, because I think if you're rich in the first place, you already have enough things open up to you. So if you start cutting off universities for the people who are less wealthy or underprivileged families, then all you're doing is creating an elitist system, really.
It shouldn't be for the rich only at all. Everybody should have an opportunity to learn and to grow.
I think if anybody really wants to go to university, whether rich or poor, they'll find a way of getting to it. If you're really intellectual, really clever, then you could get scholarships.
I hope it won't, but if you're increasing the fees from £3,000 to £9,000, it's a lot of money, you know, and like just means a lot of people leave uni in a lot more debt, and could work out pretty badly, but it could sort out the country's problems as well at the same time. So it's difficult. I don't know where it's going to go, to be honest.
In the past, that's what we strived against, so that everyone could afford an education. But maybe if certain pupils are very gifted or show lots of talent, then they should, and they can't afford to go to university, they should be able to go because they're so good. I know that happens in other countries, so maybe that's an option.
If they carry on like this, and it will, yes. We're not a high-paid family, and my daughter wouldn't be able to go in a few years' time if it carries on that they do it by the way that they're looking at doing it now.
I expect so. That's what the Conservatives want, and I think that's what they'll get, unfortunately.
My name's Tony McDonald. I'm chair of the Unite branch that looks after technical and craft staff, and I'm also convener of the joint trade unions at Bristol University.
I'm Pat Hammond, and I'm branch secretary of Unison.
Why are you here?
Because education is just crucial in looking at the big problems we all face. We fought hard to change higher education from something that was just available for the 5-6% the elite, to something that was generally available, and just in terms of making a successful, civilised, decent society that's fully fit to deal with the real problems we have, all the issues, essentially education is the way, and it's an investment well worth making, and it should be made by all the parties. In particular, our union is concerned that business and employers chip in their contribution as well as individuals and the public purse, but it's got to be an appropriate fair balance of all those.
And you've worked in the university for a number of years, I understand.
Some 41 years now, yes.
And why are you here, Pat?
Well, it's not just this generation's education, it's the generations that come after them that we're fighting for.
The spread of support is quite impressive, isn't it?
It is very impressive, yeah.
Right across the board. There's a real issue here because the government is making some 35-40% cuts. We can't take that and still be anything you consider a university. One thing you have to realise, that British universities are absolutely world class, second only to America. And if you look at the income they have to do it with, it's far greater than ours. If we had their level of income, we would just blow everybody else off the planet. And at being universities, we're far more successful than pretty much any other organisation in this country. And it's just crucial we keep that.
I have with me now Harriet Bradley, who is a representative of the Lecturers' Union, I believe.
That's right, UCU. It's a University and Colleges Union, and I'm the president of our local branch.
And why are you here to support this candlelit vigil about education today?
Because I feel extremely concerned about the future of education. I entirely support the students in what they're doing, and we in UCU have made it very clear that we support their protests, as long as they're peaceful, because we don't support violent action. But we supported all these demonstrations, rallies, and we're also, you know, many of us support the students who are sitting in the Senate House. What we're particularly keen on is that these young people are trying to promote discussion about politics at a time when a lot of people have become very apathetic. So I think it's fantastic that the students are trying to get this dialogue on the streets.
I think we've seen a mass movement here developing, yeah, with much wider base than anything we've seen before, even in the 60s, as you were saying earlier.
Yes, I think that's true. Well, I've been thinking about this because I gave a lecture to some students yesterday about youth inequality, and I talked about myself being a 60s activist and what's happening now. When I look back on what we're doing, it was a bit self-centred then. You know, I think we were thinking about our students, our courses, our universities. We're critical of what was on offer. We also wanted more freedom. But I don't think we had this more general concern about opening up the universities to people from poorer backgrounds. And that's what I think is so important. You know, when I was a student, probably about 10% of the population went to university. It's gone up to now about 40%. But this will close all that down. That's so important, because education is the key to a good life nowadays. You know, in this society, if you want a good life, you have to pay for it out of the taxes. But I think there's a lot of stereotyping about students, that they sit around idling and drinking. And it's not true. I find the students are very hard-working people, more hard-working than my generation. If it's 9,000 a year, I bet they won't feel it's worth going.
My name is Benoit. Yeah, I'm with the Camp for Education here at UWE. Yeah, since Monday the 22nd, now we are occupying the uni. But we are occupying... We are using this camp to organize, to discuss, to elaborate, to plan actions. And so, yeah, we've been around for the past 10 days.
So does your course you're doing actually have any relevance to this sort of politics of this dispute?
It's a good question. I wonder how many students learn something here at the uni that has some sort of relevance here. I noticed that lots of social science students and philosophy students and humanities students who are at the camp And those are clearly the most articulate and the most concerned by the cuts.
One of the things that we've seen in some of the demonstrations is that actually things can get violent. And many people listening will be thinking, well, look, you know, the students are shooting themselves in the foot.
It's the big question, you know, and personally, I can understand the anger. I don't think the tactics are appropriate. I think it's.
Now you're actually studying here from France. Do you think there's any links between what's been going on in France and what's happening here in Britain?
Well, yeah, the massive protests in France were also a response to the state's attack on the public sector and on the pension system. So there is definitely a link, you know, even though the attack here is way broader and deeper, which I think is an explanation for why a country that is culturally perhaps less political is responding so strongly at the moment. It's the only explanation I have for that.
So what's the difference between the mentality in France and the mentality here, do you think?
My impression is that French people are perhaps more explicit, more sensitive also. They're much more attached to the public sector also. They have a much stronger and deeper relationship to what we still call social security there, and what you increasingly call welfare here in the UK. And so French people, I think, are deeply connected to all these institutions that are a legacy of the work of the resistance under the program of the Conseil National de Résistance, or the National Council of Resistance, that worked to build a political program for what would happen to France after the Second World War. So many people have a strong, also historical consciousness of where these institutions come from. And so, yeah, there is a greater sensitivity, a greater attachment, stronger attachment to all these institutions and these values. And people are also more, they tend to rebel much faster, and they tend to trigger much faster when they feel these institutions are attacked or these values are attacked. On the other hand, I'm quite impressed with how, you know, the UK is reacting at the moment, which is quite nice to observe as well. So things are changing, definitely, and it might be that in a few years there will be an entire generation of young British people who will be much more politically aware and conscious. So things are changing, you know, this is how... You get people interested, excited, aware, knowledgeable about these big issues. So that's good.
Yeah. The turmoil within the Liberal Democrat Party over which way to vote on increases to tuition fees has continued, with the Transport Minister Norman Baker saying he wouldn't rule out resigning over the issue, and a small group of backbench MPs led by Greg Mulholland trying to postpone Thursday's vote. I'm joined now by the Edinburgh West MP Michael Crockhart, who's a parliamentary aide, a PPS, to the Scottish Secretary, Michael Moore. Michael Crockhart, are you going to resign over this issue?
It's not so much I am going to resign. I am prepared to resign, Moore.
Meaning that you would like to vote against this, but feel you can't, and therefore will resign in order to do so?
If I'm backed into a corner, yeah. I mean, the main thing, what was the big problem at the beginning, was the drip bins. Yeah.
Hello? Michael Crockhart, can you hear me? I think we've lost Michael Crockhart, so I'm going to go now to our political correspondent, Ian Watson, who's at Westminster and joins me now. Well, you heard that little brief extract that Michael Crockhart was able to tell us. Signs of growing cracks?
I think it is signs of growing cracks. I think we've got the significant bit of the conversation there, James, where he said, I'm prepared to resign.
Appalling standards. The BBC is in the news for putting out some slanderous views about Sir Bob and his fine deeds. Such tittle-tattle spreads like weeds, and many thought it true, you see, as it came from the BBC. Yes, standards fall in modern times when news reporters are inclined not to question, is it true? But just to think, oh, this'll do, let's go ahead and put it out, they do not entertain their doubt. A pity about the BBC, Many people I talk to agree that it has gone the modern way and let its standards go astray. Its bosses in their ivory towers misuse our cash, abuse their powers. It is no longer in top gear. It's lost its way. That much is clear. Producing dross now seems its goal. Jeremy Clarkson wants sick soul. While women are sacked for being old, can this be true? It is, I'm told. So I suggest to make things better, they could take notice of this letter. Give jobs to poets such as me. I am not proud. I work for free. I'm sitting waiting for the call. I've nothing else to do at all.
Family. I knew nothing about them, to my great shame, except for the, well, the airport. Dulles airport.
That was named after the oldest brother, John Foster Dulles. He was Secretary of State, and his younger brother was head of CIA. And they were the originators of brinksmanship in the Cold War. Their sister, Eleanor, was the black sheep of the family. In the 1930s, she married a Jewish guy. And her husband committed suicide under very mysterious circumstances. And then Eleanor discovered that her brothers were the lawyers for Hitler's bankers. Her brothers were arranging money, the movement of money from the United States and Great Britain into Germany to fund the rise of Hitler. Eleanor ended up getting the blackmail information to get the extra votes in the United Nations to create the State of Israel. It's a true story, never been told before.
It's amazing. I really liked Eleanor. The two brothers?
Not so much.
And I bounced back and forth with the two brothers.
Yeah. Eleanor liked John Foster Dulles, hated Alan. That's a little harsh. She didn't hate him, but she was very disappointed in him.
But there were times when Foster just seemed like just interested in money.
He did not want to break off ties with having the Solomon Cromwell law offices in Nazi Germany. He wanted them to stay open. And everybody else in his firm was saying, no, we're going to walk out. We have to shut them down.
Even during the war. I mean, bad enough in the 30s.
He stayed on the board of IG Farben after war was declared. But then so did Prescott Bush. He stayed on the board of the Union Banking Corporation.
Prescott Bush being?
The grandfather of the current president. Was a very bad man. Actually, his father-in-law gave him the job, Herbert Walker. Isn't George Herbert Walker Bush, is that? Well, the grandfather, Prescott, was the head of this bank, and it was one of three banks that were set up to... So no matter which side won World War II, the banks would survive, and all their corporate stock could be reclaimed. Oh, look, we were innocent, you know. We were victims of Nazism. So there's one in Holland, one in Berlin, and one in New York. The Prescott Bush ran the one in New York. So is it fair to say that the Bush family made money off the war? Yeah. Yeah, they did.
From both sides.
Both sides.
Why choose to do it as fiction? Why not just do it as nonfiction, or call it creative nonfiction and slap that? That's getting to be a popular...
Yeah. Creative nonfiction bothers me. It's either history or it's not. Okay. My concern was that there's a whole new generation of kids growing up that weren't even born during World War II, have no knowledge or understanding of the Holocaust, and a little less about what the 30s and 40s were like, the run-up to the war. And I thought this would be an easy way, not to spoon-feed history, but to give them a good, you know, murder mystery, love story, detective story. And Brendan, I just think, is just a brilliant author. He just came up with this whole Shakespearean arc to the book. It's a fun read.
How do you want to start? Which of the three would you like to start with? Eleanor, Foster, or Alan?
Alan. Alan, you know, was amoral. He was all for Alan. And he was the consummate beltway bureaucrat, someone who could manipulate, who could spin. No thought to long-term consequences.
Boy, why is that sounding familiar?
Yeah, yeah. John Foster Dulles was the walking human calculator, just adding up facts and figures, get to the bottom line. But there was no emotion to him, no heart, except, I think, to Eleanor. And Eleanor, I think, was probably the most brilliant of the three of them. She was the author of many books on economics. She literally devised the post-war currency system in Europe after World War II. She ran Austria, headed up the Berlin desk of the State Department, a multi-talented woman, literally put together the Social Security Administration under Roosevelt before the war started. Many talents, but in those days, women's talents weren't recognized. And Eleanor was, shall we say, not the most attractive woman in the world, and was prey to being seduced, and ended up taking a lover, who was a composite character in the book, and the lover was the one who told her that her late husband had been spying for the Zionists, and would she take his place in essence. So it was an interesting kind of twist. But Eleanor became someone who, I guess in order to save the family from dishonor, had to make sure that the whole story lay buried forever. And so she did what she had to do. These were men, the Dulles family, that financed Hitler's rise to power, sabotaged, to a certain extent, American intelligence, were on both sides of the war, and then covered it all up. And they got away with it. We named an airport after him. That's what I know when I really won, when they take the Dulles name off that airport. I think he doesn't deserve it.
The book is The Witness Tree. It's a novel. It's also history.
There's more truth in this novel than in most history books.
I've been speaking with the author John Loftus, the other author Brendan Howley, and The Witness Tree is published by Random House.
Tonight, our special guest is someone who, born in 1953, grew up in a Russian elite family, as you could say. His father was a general in the KGB. He became a Japanologist. He is one of the most interesting and insightful critics of the KGB today. His name is Konstantin
Preobrazhensky. Konstantin, how are you doing tonight?
Very well, thank you. Good evening.
Good
thank
evening.
You for a beautiful introduction.
You've written so many interesting books. The Spy Who Loved Japan, and what was the other one? The one about the FSB?
Yes, and my recent book is KGB in Russian Emigration. It was published in the United States. It tells how Russian intelligence is penetrating now United States through Orthodox Church, through Russian colony, by merging Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia to Moscow Patriarchate, which is controlled by KGB and by Putin.
I remember back in World War II, where Stalin, you know, instead of making war on the Russian Orthodox Church, enlisted it as part of his propaganda campaign. But you uncovered something amazing. How many members of the bishops in the Russian Orthodox Church did you find were actually KGB informants?
Practically all. In the Soviet period,
my God.
It was impossible to become a bishop without being approved by the KGB. Why? Because the bishop got a privilege to mix with the foreigners, not only to go abroad, but even to speak to the foreigners visiting Russia. It was allowed only by the KGB. Every Russian citizen, every Soviet citizen who contacted a foreigner voluntarily was suspected of espionage.
It was the secret war against the Jews. This is my last book, sort of a history of our covert operations in the Middle East. Yeah, I'm afraid that the president's grandfather and his great-grandfather were not nice guys. They teamed up with the famous Democratic family, the Harrimans. My favorite Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, passed a whole bunch of laws saying no monopolies, no cartels, no trust in the United States. Well, the Wall Street robber barons got together in 1918. They passed the Webb-Pomeroy Act and saying you can have cartels and trusted monopolies overseas. So a number of people, including the president's grandfather and the Harrimans, combined forces to invest in countries. They invested in a group of very radical Saudis and brought them to the throne of Saudi Arabia. They invested in Bolshevik Russia, of all places. And sadly, they invested in pre-war Germany. They made the early loans to the Nazi Party, built the first Nazi Party headquarters, and in many ways funded Hitler's campaign. By some estimates, 70% of the money that went to rearm the Third Reich came from Wall Street. Now, sadly, Herbert Walker and Harriman, who were partners in this enterprise, not for ideology, just for money, just for profits. Prescott Bush, the son, became the executive officer, if you will, for Union Banking Corporation. And that, to be blunt, was a wholly owned Nazi subsidiary. Its entire function was to launder money in and out of the Third Reich. The company was seized during World War II under the Trading with the Enemy Act, but then eventually returned to the Bush family. But the whole story has still not emerged, and I have a great deal of information I'll be releasing in my next book on that.
Yeah, all of these guys seem to be going back to an organization called Al-Muhajirun, which means the emigrants. It was the recruiting arm of Al-Qaeda in London. They specialized in recruiting kids whose families had emigrated to Britain but who had British passports, and they would use them for terrorist work. But what they had in common was they were all emigrant groups in Britain recruited by this Al-Muhajirun group. They were headed by, Captain Hook, the imam in London, the Finsbury
right.
Mosque, without the arm. He was the head of that organization. Now, his assistant was a guy named Aswat, Harun Rashid Aswat.
Aswat.
Aswat is believed to be the mastermind of all the bombings in London.
On the 7-7 and 7-21, this is the guy, we think.
This is the guy, and what's really embarrassing is that the entire British police are out chasing him, and one wing of the British government, MI6, or the British Secret Service,
right.
has been hiding him. And this has been a real source of contention between CIA,
hold on, John.
Justice Department, and Britain.
MI6 has been hiding him. Are you saying that he has been working for them?
Oh, I'm not saying it. This is what the Muslim sheikh said in an interview in a British newspaper back in 2001.
So he's a double agent, or what?
He's a double agent.
So he's working for the Brits to try to give them information about Al-Qaeda, but in reality, he's still an Al-Qaeda operative.
Yeah. The CIA and the Israelis all accused MI6 of letting all these terrorists live in London, not because they were getting Al-Qaeda information, but for appeasement. It was one of those, you leave us alone, we leave you alone kind of things.
Well, we left him alone too long then.
Absolutely. Now, we knew about this guy, Aswat. Back in 1999, he came to America. The Justice Department wanted to indict him in Seattle because him and his buddy were trying to set up a terrorist training school in Oregon.
So they indicted the buddy, right? But why didn't they indict him?
Well, it comes out, we've just learned that the headquarters of the U.S. Justice Department ordered the Seattle prosecutors not to touch Aswat.
Hello. Now, hold on. Why?
And that's, well, apparently Aswat was working for British intelligence. Now, Aswat's boss, the one-armed Captain Hook, he gets indicted 2 years later. So the guy above him and below him get indicted, but not Aswat. Now, there's a split of opinion within U.S. intelligence. Some people say that the British intelligence fibbed to us. They told us that Aswat was dead, and that's why the New York group dropped the case. That's not what most of the Justice Department thinks. They think that it was just, again, covering up for this very publicly affiliated guy with Al-Mujahroon. He was a British intelligence plant. So all of a sudden, he disappears. He's in South Africa. We think he's dead. We don't know he's down there. Last month, the South African Secret Service come across the guy.
Yeah, now the CIA says, oh, he's alive. Our CIA says, okay, let's arrest him. But the Brits say no again?
The Brits say no. Now, at this point, 2 weeks ago, the Brits know that the CIA wants to get a hold of Haroon. So what happens? He takes off again, goes right to London. He isn't arrested when he lands. He isn't arrested when he leaves.
Even though he's on a watch list.
He's on the watch list. The only reason he could get away with that was if he was working for British intelligence. He was a wanted man.
And then takes off the day before the bombings, as I understand it?
Yeah, and goes to Pakistan. The Pakistanis arrest
him. They jail him.
They jail him. He's released within 24 hours, back to Southern Africa, goes through Zimbabwe, and is arrested in Zambia.
Trying to
now
get
the U.S., the U.S., we're trying to get our hands on this guy.
I do know how I survive. Yes, I do know why. and shall be.
I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with this vicious racist, with this governor having his lips dripping with the words of this position and other dictation, one day right down in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment line. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's theirs? Don't you know you better run, run, run.
Children can't be fooled, raise them in a household. That's where they should all be schooled.
If you're sick and tired of living this way, and honestly down cause you wanna see change, we love our people more than a waste. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today.
This is for the youths on the road that
want to grow, that want to live past 30 and circle the globe. The only guarantee we receive from life is death. So if we're gonna live, we might as well live it the best. Watch the thoughts that you keep, cause they always manifest. Follow steps from the ancestors to help your quest. My life's blessed, cause I find inner peace, minus the stress from the things I don't need. Be the ruler of your destiny, control your legacy. Build with your brother if he brings good energy. Wolves and sheep's clothing only bring treachery. Never follow fashion, set the pattern for the remedy. Real friends will always be, fake ones will come around. Glued to the screen like a theme, fam, only Dan. I love the next gen, so I put the pad to pen. The flower needs a stem from the start to the end.
Sick and tired of living this way, and honestly down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than our ways. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today.
Have to build like the structures with the mortar. Free like the sun, moon, stars and the waters. Have your fathers raising families with sons, wives and daughters. Slaves free your troubled minds, escaping all your quarters. In this new age of man-made days that are so crazed. Have to hold your sanity, we're on the last page. Open book that's everlasting. Minutes keep on passing while my seatbelt is fastened. In my mind I'm asking, does this man-made powerhouse cover us with any doubts? As I put a spliff resting on my mouth. This is a land of insecurities. There's no assurity that any cure would be the way to see us torn and free. Gotta be or you can be. Positive mentality is the only way that you will thrive in this reality. But certain man that's tooled up know what time it is. Making differences and changing life by how they really live.
You're sick and tired of living this way, and honestly down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than our ways. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's why we're trying to build with our brothers today. If you're sick and tired of living this way, and honestly down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than our ways. That's why we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain.